Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends. It's me, Justin Robert Young.
And Brian Brushwood.
Man, don't bury the lead. Justin, where are you?
I am live from Cleveland, Ohio, where we are on the eve of the Republican National Convention, wherein presumptive nominee Donald Trump will be named the actual nominee, therefore kicking off the two-week period where we finalize who's running for president and then make them fight to the death on a remote island.
I'm sorry I missed you. I was just in Ohio myself. I did a magic lecture in Columbus, which I assume is, two or three hours away from Cleveland?
Yeah. You know, if you don't travel by teleport, it is, I believe, 3 hours south.
Gentlemen, that's great, but I'm sorry. I just got breaking news.
Uh-oh.
We're gonna try an experiment here in Weird Things. You know, we've done scenarios before. I think we're gonna do a scenario that's gonna be a multi-parter. We'll do a little bit part today. We'll do a little bit part next podcast.
Oh wow!
Yes, I love this already.
All right, we're gonna go to our favorite scenario: plague.
Oh, I thought it was snakes, but that's okay. Oh, I guess a plague of snakes. Plague
spread by snakes. Whatever you want, whatever the vector you want, Brian. Whatever makes you happy. And the news is that there's plague. It's been spreading. People are dropping like flies. I mean, as soon as we get off the podcast, like, Brian, I'm sorry to say, you start hearing coughing from downstairs.
Dude, I've already got it. If you're talking about Pokemon Go fever.
No, we're not going to talk about that.
Oh, okay.
That's the next segment. We're talking about actual plague. By the time we finish the podcast, your family's dead.
Oh, good God. No, that's awful. I'm against it.
Who's laughing now, Brian?
I vote against it. Justin, you're at the national convention. See if you can start a motion on the floor.
It's wiping its way through, goes to the floor. People are coughing and wheezing, dropping, okay?
So it's respiratory or it appears to be airborne, right?
Yeah, whatever. It's spreading, okay? And it's people are just dying left and right. And you guys both get a little woozy, but you survive. And so the survival rate's like 0.1% or something, okay? All right. So there are people around, but there's not really people around, okay?
So it's roughly the equivalent of, because that was the promise of the neutron bomb, is that if you don't detonated a neutron bomb above a city, you could instantly irradiate all the people and keep most of the infrastructure intact so that you can just move in and take over.
Yeah, you just have to put up a couple fans and, you know, just waft it on out of there. Next thing you know, you move in, bada bing, bang, boom.
Real estate's never been cheaper. Hang some air fresheners around and you're good.
Yeah.
So, Brian.
Yeah. Yeah.
Things start to fall apart. Internet service, telephone service, all of that starts to fall apart, right?
Yeah.
But for some reason, you get hold of like a friend's like a ham radio or whatever, you know, and you're listening to there and you hear pleas from people like, hey, we're in Tucson, you know, if you're anybody out there, let us know, whatever. You've hoarded food. You've got a bunch of food hoarded up in your house, you know. You burned the bodies in your neighborhood. You took my advice instead of just leaving there to rot and fester.
Right. Okay.
And you're listening to the radio and you're like, better yet. Forget the radio. Now listen to radio because you're not smart enough for that. I kid, Brian.
No. You're right. That's a fact, actually. There's no need to kid on that one.
Yeah.
That's why we always used to make fun of the Ham Nation show because we were too scared to ask.
you get your, I don't know, it's 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Curled up in your bed behind your barricaded doors because there still are people out there, but it's scary people. You've got your canned food, everything like this, and there's a knock on your door.
I mean, I assume that I just pretend to not be there, but my guess is that they're probably going to be rather insistent. Am I right?
Yeah, they're insistent. You see, you hear, you ignore it a couple hours later.
I'm doing recon before I so much as make a whisper. I'm peeking out the windows. I'm climbing on the roof, looking over the edge. Is this a gang of marauders running around?
One scruffy-looking person wrapped up in rags.
Yeah, but I mean, I just dodged a bullet on this plague thing. I mean, surely he's got to understand. Wait, by any chance, is it Justin?
I don't know. How are you going to find out?
All right, I'm going to knock on the door. I'm like, what do you want?
Bri, it's me, Justin.
God damn it. Over here. Justin Robert Young?
Who else?
Why are you in Austin? I haven't spoken to you since the falling.
I don't know if you got the news, Brian, but there was a big of an apocalypse. stuck in Ohio.
Okay, all right. So he makes it to my house. Well, I'm going to let him in, right?
Wait, you're not gonna test me with some knowledge that only you and I would know?
Well, but it wasn't a shapeshifter plague. It was just a regular plague. I mean, okay. First of all, do you know why I wouldn't? Because if I did, you would mock me relentlessly, saying, Brian, don't be an idiot.
This isn't the time. This isn't the time. We are the future of humanity. And by the way, if somebody did want to break in, it's not like there's countless hundreds of hours of us talking to each other on you know, for anybody to see. They could just know enough to impersonate me. You need to ask me a question that only you and I would know.
All right.
Right here now for everybody to hear.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So when we watched Rick and Morty on top of your rooftop and I fell and ate it because of the stupid layout of the up and down on the deck, I woke up with a part of my body that hurt real bad. What was that part of my body?
I don't know. How about your stupid brain for having to ask me that question?
Damn it!
Idiot.
Damn it! I knew it! This is why. Get in here!
Also, it was your hip.
Oh no! Wait! Get back!
Wait, it wasn't.
Ribs.
I thought it was your side. Your ribs. Oh, whatever. I'm sorry. That was an inch off.
All right. Here you are, hanging out. Apocalypse.
Yeah, man. So nutty thing. Everyone we ever loved is gone. So you figure what? 1 in 1,000 survived. So let's think of everyone we've ever met and pick the people we'd hope most are dead and assume they're alive.
Okay. As much as I'd love to indulge making this into yet another exercise of your enemies list, like, can we actually do a little bit of apocalypse planning here?
Well, I figured that, you know, look, it's been a few months since I've done a podcast and you're here. I just figured we would just night attack it up. I've already pressed record. I'm saving this.
We're now officially like the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern in this global drama.
Yes, exactly. I mean, what are we gonna do? I already have a farm in the backyard. I'm harvesting potatoes because I've reread The Martian 4 or 5 times. A lot of it doesn't apply, but all my poop is in the backyard and I'm growing potatoes. What else is there to do?
As Justin looks at the mounds and mounds of canned food and empty cans in a corner covered in flies. As a matter of fact, I'm growing my own food. Like, yeah, how much of your calories are actually coming from those potatoes?
I actually used all those cans to shape the garden. They're as good as bricks, man. They're nice and solid.
Okay, so we're not going to live at your house forever, right? We're not just going to, you know, this isn't just going to be gray gardens with the two of us.
I mean, I don't know. How bad would that be? I already have photographs of our glory days. Look, this is us. I printed this out before the power went out. It's you and me live on stage at Dragon Con. Remember that time?
Okay, I do. We need to reconnect with society.
There is no society. Oh, wait. You're saying we need to find an audience member. We just need one. And then we can go back on a road trip.
Fine, let's go with that. Who said the glory days had to be dead, Brian? We need to find an audience.
All right.
Well, I like the idea that Brian's got like 6 or 7 mangy dogs living in his house that he puts into the podcast room. They all have chairs.
It's like, well, I you know what? I thought maybe this might happen. So I've got these giant water or I have the water purifiers. I stole all these survival kits. I got this ATV. I got these solar panels to recharge. I got this whole van that's able to crawl over debris. Which direction you want to go, Justin? Which way do we go to look for more people?
Well, I mean, I would say we probably should go downtown, right? That's where people would probably gather.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like we should play the smaller venues first. I don't know.
I just think that you're still scarred that there might be traffic.
I mean, the construction, I mean, I guarantee you they haven't fixed MOPAC yet. It's
like, even with 0.1% of the population, right? So they're like, but, I mean, should we wait until 7?
In all seriousness, though, it does seem like that's just sniper trap heaven downtown, right?
Who's killing each other? For what?
Whoever remains. Whoever remains. I've seen.
Well, that brings up an interesting question, though, is that on one hand, you're like, why are people doing that? But then a lot of people probably flipped out and gotten kind of nuts. The survivors may have gone wacky, but... So, Brian, let's talk about your choice of vehicle. You say, all right, you guys are determined to go on the road. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, okay, so there's a bunch of different thoughts here, right? The problem is if you do anything motorized, you are telegraphing your position to any marauder within, like, literally a mile to 4 miles distance. Max...
Well, let me ask you a question, though, about the marauders. What are they marauding? What are they... A marauder implies they want something from you, but when there's, like... 99.99% of everybody's dead.
Let me give you a hint. We're talking about a world where there's all the canned food you can eat, all the recorded entertainment you can watch. There's only one thing you can't get without other physical people. And my guess is that's what the marauders are going to want, is physical people.
Yeah, they want your supple flesh, friend.
Exactly. Or my old squishy flesh. My guess is they don't care. My guess is that it's better than the corpse or the livestock.
So Brian's fear of a post-apocalypse is rape.
A little bit.
Oh, wait. I thought that wasn't a live comedy. That's not what you're talking about.
Yeah, you were describing applause?
No. I mean, the question is, it's not what you know they want. It's what you don't know they want. So anyway, in the zombie survival guide, it suggested that you should ride a bike because it's quiet, maneuverable. You can get around everywhere.
You're an open target, easy to be taken off with a Garrett line across the street. Yeah, it sounds like a great idea.
I mean, but the other one is just you're an invitation to, you're a noise machine.
We're not going after zombies, right? Zombies are not our problem. Like, yes, somebody might stalk us. That is a fear of leaving the house. But I would much rather be in a car where somebody could take a shot at us with a gun and we won't immediately die.
All right, fine. Here's my compromise. I found this over here. There's an ice cream truck. That way, we're playing the jaunty music, and if there are survivors, they'll know that sweet, sweet candy awaits them.
No, well, number one,
the zombie apocalypse guide. Well, I think that's a horrible idea because what happens? I turn a corner and there is a wall of zombies. You know, I'm in the horrific scenario where there's thousands and thousands of zombies, not one. I'm dead. How about an electric vehicle if you want silence?
Well, I mean, you know, if you could just pluck one off the tree, but the conceit is what you have on hand, and so I don't know that
we
want
to L.A. I right down the street. I'm good.
All right. Well, it's I.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what. Would you say there's got to be a Prius in your neighborhood, right?
Yeah.
Like, we can't just go run up into somebody's house that's already dead.
I think down the road, mom and dad got a golf cart. You can get that. Throw a solar panel on top.
If you want to go distance, you need motorized vehicle. Why not make an armored vehicle? You know, why not take something like a Winnebago, whatever, put plate, protect it. You can put tons of cans of fuel in there.
That's a massive trade-off for maneuverability, right? You can't go off-road. You can't skirt around stuff. You're a prime target for
entrapment. Two stages, right? First things first, you are about 15 minutes outside of town. Do we want to investigate Austin? And then if Austin proves to be inhospitable and we feel that we need to go somewhere else, then we grab ourselves another larger vehicle that can go for highway driving.
Yeah, that works for me.
I'm building my armored RV because wherever I go, I'm going to be living in it. You know, I'm not going to be going to some town and like leaving my vehicle behind. I'm living in my vehicle.
Okay, why would you pick like the biggest gas guzzlingest comfort based vehicle to get around? Because
it could be my home for the next 3 or 4 years.
Well, yeah, if you're in a survivalist mode though, you could do that in a station wagon. You don't need no RV.
I think that before you start going stir crazy, I think that if you know you're going to be stuck inside of there for several days.
I mean, okay, I will have the power of turning left, whereas you will have the power of wishing for highways.
There's no other cars, Brian.
You're telling me there's not cars littered all over the GD road?
I think that, you know, people stayed home, pulled over, died.
Yeah.
You know? Very few people just died on the spot in their car. It took a couple hours to do it, so they're all like went home for the most part.
I mean, all right, if we're drawing the type of plague.
If we're drawing parallels to every time there's other been outbreaks or epidemics, what the behavior is, or hurricanes, stuff like that, the streets are pretty empty.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Okay, so the streets are pretty empty all through the world.
Well, first, all right, do we have anything? Well, number one, DM, when I came from Cleveland to Austin, did I run into people? Like, did I survive barely? Like what was my experience?
You saw sporadic people. You did see people. People weren't really overtly hostile. They were, if you didn't go near a supermarket or whatever, near somebody else's territory, because that's where people would probably hold up, would be, instead of like trying to take the food to their house, they would just go to where the food is and protect that. So, you know, you might pass a Costco that you see is all boarded up and you know there are people inside of there.
Yeah.
And, you know, as far as approaching or whatever, and that's the thing, you're afraid to approach places like that because everybody's this mix. They want to reconnect, but they also want to protect their resources. And your fear is that, like, man, if I get too close to there, they might have somebody with a sniper on a roof. And you might periodically be going through towns and stuff, and you pass, let's say, a Costco, and you'd see somebody on the roof, and you're like, there's somebody there with a sniper rifle, and better to just stay clear.
Okay. All right. So there is a, it's not like everybody's turned into like purge behavior, right? Like,
no, not you, but you've not, there's so many few people left that you really haven't made contact with anybody because everybody's been hiding from everybody else.
So think about it this way. If we have only 1 in 1,000 survivors, then that means in all of Austin, in the greater Austin area, there are only 1,000 living individuals. So picture in all of downtown, you're looking at maybe 300, 400 people, which, you know, you could picture in a high school auditorium. I guess all of Austin could fit in a high school auditorium at this point. That's going to be hard to even encounter another person.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It does seem like trust has to start somewhere.
I'm gonna say that when you meet somebody, chances are 50-50. They're more than likely they will be trusting and they will be kind. But your concern is that, you know, the first time you saw a Costco and you walked near there, you heard a rifle shot. You tend to avoid people because even though most people will be kind, only 10% are hyper aggressive.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me like the first thing that needs to happen is trade. And really, even marauders are looking to engage in a type of trade, just a highly unfair one, where they take all your resources and give you nothing. Like, no matter what you have, everyone has some things and wants other things. And it seems like the first stable place to meet other people would be like a de facto marketplace. Because going back to Richard Garriott, when he made the video game Ultima Online, there was a lot of stuff that was thought out and a lot of stuff was just not even considered. And one of the things is, where would people go to trade all of their stuff that they looted off of corpses? And there was just this one corner behind, off to the side of Britannia, that everybody, no matter what server it was on, everybody knew that's where you could go to get stuff. And you would just run around shouting and trading stuff because in the city, you couldn't kill each other. Outside, everyone could kill everyone. And that was, the game highly favored the killing of other people and looting all of their stuff. And if you got killed and looted, it highly favored hiding in the forest until you watch someone die and then run out and loot their corpse and then run to the city where you would be safe. So I would imagine something like that might emerge in Austin if there was some power that declared this area safe for trade.
So you go to downtown Austin, and you're looking for your market, you're looking for your whatever. It's not there. You see people watching you. You see people peering out, but nobody. It's not there.
I didn't want to go down there to begin with. I defer to you, Justin. What are we going to do?
I mean, we have to reach out. I mean, like the goal is to meet people on some sort of neutral ground, right? Unless, I mean, that's if we want to reconnect with society. I just kind of feel like that's the natural. At some point, we are either going to run into a resource problem or we're going to go stir crazy. It's a miracle mathematically that we're both alive, right?
Yeah.
So we have to find that out. Also, we got to stock up. Want to know why? Because we're going on a road trip to L.A. See if Andrew's alive.
So I notice how, like, Brian's instincts weren't like, well, let's start this place for people to meet.
Oh no.
That's why there's not a place to meet, because people are like, oh, I'm not gonna do it.
Well, yeah, this is why you'll get that shepherd mentality. It's gonna be a lot like the American South, where it's we're not farmers where we grow our crops and trust that year over year we'll get results kind of like we did the year beforehand. We're gonna be like shepherds in that our entire fortunes are on us or near us at all times, and we have to view everyone else with mistrust, and we need to do things like display power and send warning shots to let people know we're serious, because we can't rely on calling the cops or whatever.
All right. So you guys decide you're going to go west.
Well, I mean, it's like...
I wouldn't. If we're going, I mean, first of all, why we got to go anywhere? We got an
thanks,
aquifer.
Brian.
I mean, I'm just saying, convince me there. Maybe we hear messages of where people are.
Nope, you don't know. You know.
See.
I think the first mission would just be to put yourself in a sarcophagus and call it a day.
No. Look, we've got an aquifer with relatively clean water. We've got certainly there's enough food throughout the city to last us.
Well, like let's say Justin for whatever reason Austin was closest, but now he needs to go back to Oakland to check on Ashley.
Yeah. Well,
he's like, Brian, I need to go to Oakland to check on Ashley. Will you come with me?
So how are we going to get there? Are we going to go straight across the desert? Are we going to go up through the Rocky Mountains? Or that's a perilous.
You're going to drive on roads for one.
By carrying all our fuel? And I can't get to the West Coast on one tank of gas. We're just going to hope and forage
it's
on
been,
the way.
It's only a month or two in. You know, there's still going to be gas and gas stations.
All right. Well,
diesel.
Okay. Well, then I guess it's a road trip. How do we want to get there, Justin?
I like Brian's like, if chemistry is fighting against me.
You know what it is? I've played the Oregon Trail. I know how this ends. I mean, that's not an insignificant trip.
Also, your new name is Poop Butt, like all the other people that I had on the Oregon Trail.
So I could put, he croaked in his Converses. All right. So I assume even though you need to get up north, I guess we will take I-10 because that's going to be, if anything's blocked on the road, that's all flat. It's going to be hot as hell, but we could just drive off road for giant chunks.
Yeah.
Of it. And then we're going to have to go up, the PCH?
So you're going to stop, but you're coming by my place, then you might as well check on me too.
We're going to go to both. We're going to check on people. Yeah. So we do that and then we take the five.
All right. So we get all the way. I assume.
No, you just made the decision. We'll pick this up next week.
Oh, damn it. Okay. If we're going west, maybe we'll find Andrew Ming. Damn. Can we at least practice our act on the road?
We'll find out what some of the other implications of this global plague were. What else happened?
Next week. I'll tell you what, this is a keep them coming back kind of show. The kind of show that you should reward by going to patreon.com/weirdthings.
Hells yeah, dude. It keeps us regular. You are our Metamucil. Yeah, we want to make this a priority to do it every single week for you guys. We don't care how much you contribute. We would just love it if you join the ranks of the proud and be a patron. Literally anything. If you met us at an airport, would you buy us a $5 beer? If so, we'd love to have it.
I'll tell you what, look at that. Hey, Brian, how many patrons we got?
We got 420, although it was a lot funner when we had 666. So I wouldn't mind asking people to give us a little boosty there. A little boosty A.
thank you to everybody who does support the show. And yeah, you guys are great.
Hey,
Patreon.com/weirdthings.
So I'm going to ask a question, and my guess is Andrew Main knows, or you, Justin, know more than me. And if not the two of us, then maybe it'll just be an open-ended question we can ask somebody to educate us on. But I was thinking about, like, what's a weird things scenario that's tied in with the Republican National Convention or you know, just the general hotbed of contention that politics is these days. And last night, there was a Reddit post linking to a Christopher Hitchens documentary in which he described in detail the horrifying way Saddam Hussein took power live on television by first having an obviously tortured individual come out and obviously defeated, confess his crimes against the state and ask to be executed. But before I do, let me name all my conspirators. And then as names were happened, abject panic goes through the crowd. And people, some of them, in order to save themselves, start shouting, glory to Saddam Hussein. He's the bestest forever. Everybody, hooray, Saddam. And I don't know if I heard this part right, but it sounded like he said the other half that weren't named as conspirators were handed weapons and told to kill the others. Yep. Is that what happened live on television?
He wasn't a nice guy.
Yeah, that's.
I don't know, guys. I saw a documentary in there, flying kites and stuff in Baghdad.
I mean, I understand that Saddam Hussein is, you know, he was never somebody who came from the world of diplomacy. You know, he came from a strong man. Like, he was far more Tony Soprano than he was a politician, and this is the kind of stuff that happens.
Well,
right?
I guess,
like,
I guess
some, like, Heisenberg stuff.
What was extraordinary to me to read this was, I guess, in my lifetime, I've never seen media used in that kind of naked, honest display of power grab. There's always been this veneer, even with a wink and a nod, where it's like, hey, we're not going to, we're going to pretend, you know, like we're really, we're the ones under attack here. But it's like, that doesn't sound like the way that went at all. He was just all like, yeah, no, I'm killing everyone who doesn't agree.
Well, but I mean, it was in a form of a tribunal, though. I mean, it was a trial. You know, that was the context was this was a trial, and we see it for what it is. But the construct around what it was this was legal. This was the rule of law being applied. That there was these enemies of the state, not him, and they're being tried and they're found guilty. And you know, these things always happen in some form of some context that on paper says, oh, well, this is folly, you know, law and order, when reality is that it's, you know, not.
Man, so. Makes me want to watch that documentary. But yeah. Wow.
Chilling. It's absolutely creepy when you get into, you know, the particulars of all things. And, you know, we see that. So we just had, an attempted coup in Turkey. And when Erdogan, you know, when he got back and, you know, when it was defeated, he's promising, like, you know, vengeance upon his enemies. You're thinking, like, man, that's not a Western response. The Western response is, you know, you're going to face the rule of law. You know, we're going to take it to court. Where he's like, basically, planning blood vengeance on all of them, which is like,
yeah,
you know, like, wow, that's a very different approach than we, on the surface at least, have in a democracy, where we're like, yeah, you will be tried by the state. You know, you're going to have your, you know, chance, and then, yeah, we'll make sure you're gonna, you know, get punished. But it's very interesting.
Yeah, a coup for which he, the president, claims was masterminded in the Poconos, the home of the of the Borscht Belt comedy circuit.
Wait, for
real?
Turkey
reals? Coup? Yeah. I'd prefer a pastrami. Ba-dum-tsh.
That's amazing, because you know that's where I met, or Bonnie and I both worked at the same camp in different years in the Pocono Mountains. That's amazing.
Yeah. There is a cleric who was a former ally that now is exiled here in America, and the president. That is a story that, because I've been heading out here to Cleveland, I have not had an opportunity to follow as close as I would like. But I would not be shocked if we continued to get more and more information on exactly what that coup was, because there seemed to be some fairly credible signs that point to, maybe it might not have been as legitimate as it was portrayed.
When you say legitimate, I guess a legitimate coup would be like a well-organized one versus thing.
There are theories that he staged this as a coup to fail.
That the
president staged it as a coup to fail, and that him putting it on somebody that isn't even in Turkey or a government official is his way of saying, like, well, look, Bob, these rabble rousers try to tell you guys. Anyway, back to me killing or imprisoning 6,000 people that I probably didn't like anyway.
Oof. Saying it's some kind of job. There's a
so I'm going to change the topic, if I may, from politics and global events.
Yeah.
To global events.
Oh, okay, good.
We have had... It has been an amazing couple weeks watching the spread of that virus that Brian brought up at the top of the show, the Pokemon Go. Mm-hmm. You can tell how much I am not of that generation by the number of times I will call it Pokemon.
Calm it down, study. Chuck Tingle.
What's that?
I said, calm it down, Chuck Tingle.
you know the Chuck Tingle books, right? Okay. Well, we'll save it for after.
Let's just say he is a fine Hugo Award nominated purveyor of hilariously titled gay erotica.
Yes, lately getting a lot of headlines for titling them after current events about like the Brexit and so on.
Okay then, so as I was saying. We've been watching the spread of this Pokemon, and it's been fascinating because if you want an example of, you know, when you talk about virility and you talk about watching something just all of a sudden overnight, it's everywhere. This has been an amazing study of that. Now, I will attest to the addictive properties of the company that came up with Pokemon Go did Ingress first.
Yeah, sure.
And yeah.
My buddy Peter plays Ingress, and it like drives me nuts because – he will be driving and will be playing Ingress. We'll be walking along and he'll be playing Ingress. And I will, you know, Peter's been on his podcast and I'll be like, hey, so anyhow, and he'll be like, what? And he'll look up from his phone. I don't mean to out him here, but it is like, he just like, you know, he's like quit smoking recently. I'm like, great. If you quit Ingress, be more impressed.
Yeah. To put it in perspective, now Ingress already is highly, highly addictive, but that is with a manufactured backstory that essentially is like the Enlightened versus Anarcho. Anarchist, whatever. You take the well-beloved 20, 30-year property of Pokemon and put it on there. Here's here is an actual stampede in New York that a Vulpix or something?
A Vaporeon.
Vaporeon.
Vaporeon manifests and everyone, they got to catch them all.
Well, that is a very high-level Pokemon and it is a common leader in the gyms, which is basically what you do. If you are under a rock and you don't know how this game is played, effectively it is geographically based.
We're watching a flood of people across a street, all with their phones in front of them. It is a Black Mirror episode. I mean, it's just...
it really is.
And it's... I'm going to say, yes, there are some girls there, but I'm going to say that they only appear to be Asian.
Well, my daughter would be among them if she could be. She's already way into it and already figuring out what's where. She was all excited To go to the movies, not so much to see The Secret Life of Pets, but because at the bar next door, 400 Rabbits, there was a gym. If only she was one level higher, she could go to the Pokemon gym.
Wow. This is a very interesting, I find this fascinating for several reasons. One is we're watching this spread. We're taking a highly addictive process. And as Brian, as you pointed out, we take this 30-year-old franchise that is this incredibly familiar. Everybody know, like, I know none of these characters. So when you say this, I'm like, okay. You would take these fascinating but endearing characters to people. You tie that together. You get that nostalgia click pop in the brain. Put those together and you have an amazing phenomenon, plus augmented reality. We're watching, you know, this mass participation in a huge augmented reality game.
Yeah, which is
You know what? For the 5% that don't know, do you want to explain to them quick, you know, how the game works?
Yeah, so basically here's how the game works in a nutshell. Effectively, all over your world are, if you play the game, the main interface is think of it as a Google Maps kind of interface. And you walk around and find two different types of interactions. A Poke Stop, which are all, you know, various different physical landmarks. You check them for supplies, Pokeballs, power-ups, stuff like that. And then randomly, as if you know, you were just literally walking through the, you know, you're an RPG when you are attacked by, you know, a gang or something, a Pokemon will appear. You engage it and try to catch it with the Pokeballs. The AR comes in because if you leave AR on, which does drain battery, you will see the Pokemon literally in front of you, wherever your camera's pointing.
Well, and staying in one space, like you can lean left, lean right. Like I finally got it loaded, and I'm in the minivan, just getting it started, and I look, and they're sitting on the steering wheel. No matter where I aim the camera, it's just sitting there on the steering wheel. I'm like, oh, I guess I gotta catch this first one. Gotta catch the first one was the original commandment of Pokemon.
Exactly.
Here's the thing. These things partly, the question is trend or fad right here. I mean, this has to be a fad, right?
I mean, at this point, we are not talking about a popular game. We have never seen a game explode like this. It was a week ago that it passed more active users than Twitter. It has retention rates that are double what we consider addicting games like Clash of Clans or Angry Birds or Hearthstone or something like that. This is a social phenomenon, the likes of which we really haven't seen before. Around where I live in Oakland, around Lake Merritt, is a very active Poke Stop where, you know, there's a lot of Pokemon around the lake regularly. And it is 24/7 people around the lake. I go running in the morning, I see them. We go walking around at night to play Pokemon, me and Ashley, we see them. The last night there was one particular area that was pretty hot, easily had 50 people just standing around playing the game. So yes, it will certainly cool down at some point. Whether or not we are at that point, I think remains to be seen. But if it were to completely start to atrophy, the failure, like the absolute failure point of their trajectory now is Clash of Clans, right? Like it's still bigger than the biggest game that we've ever seen on mobile.
Yeah. I see. So you're saying like the number two slot is so far beneath them right now. So,
let me throw out some thoughts here. One is right. You know, so Niantic, which was a Google lab, which is the ones behind the engineering behind it. One is like somebody at Google right now is going, man, if only we'd been able to tie this into Google Glass.
Yep.
We'd have sold a billion of those. Two is thinking forward, because the augmented reality is obviously a big part of why this, I mean, it's a lot of reasons why it's successful, but what makes it fun and neat and rather just a mapping kind of game is the idea that you are when you look through your phone as your lens, you see these things there, you are there, you're part of the game, you're playing the game. Not in some level of abstraction in gameplay, but like you're really there. If we move forward and we say we have Microsoft HoloLens or some augmented reality game, what does this mean when you start playing Minecraft Go?
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Go downtown to the city park where people are building things, and you go to a place and you build something, it stays there until somebody tears it down.
Well, and so real quick side jack is, of course, the sensationalist headlines we're going to get. We're going to get people who are doing dangerous things. People are being lured into situations by predators who are using Pokemon Go or whatever. Picture for me the Venn diagram of the demographics who spent the last 20 years complaining that technology just keeps everyone indoors and the demographics of the people who are now likely to start complaining that Pokemon Go is...
I don't think it's worth talking. I mean, it's like when tens of millions of people are playing a game. Yeah, stuff's going to happen statistically. It's not even to me, it's like, yeah, whatever.
That's not my point. My point is finally, this is a game that is designed to do one thing, to get kids to go out and play. And my guess is the exact people who are going to complain about that are the exact people who are complaining that kids weren't going out to play.
I mean, I think there is certainly a wry irony considering how much there has been media hand-wringing about video games pretty much my entire life, that this seems to be almost the exact opposite of that conventional argument, right? This is something that you basically can get free high value Pokemon if you walk a 5K.
Right.
Like if you walk a 10K, if you walk 2 kilometers, like these are almost, if it were marketed as a fitness game, I don't know if you would have to do much tweaking to it.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, Brian, I hear you. I'm more excited about the discussion of where does this go? Not what's going to be the stupid reaction from people around it, because it's always going to be that, you know? I was saying on Twitter that, like, the thing that the news is waiting for is the first Tesla autopilot Pokemon Go accident.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, finally. The headline to beat all headlines.
Yeah. So what's next? So, you know, here you're going to face the eventually – it theoretically could be wrong, you know, and by personal experience, people playing that same sort of level of interactivity, it doesn't diminish. But, you know, they're going to implement new features in the games. They're going to get that. It's going to change gameplay. This is going to fundamentally change gameplay. Every other property, people out there, Disney's going to be looking at, how do we do this? Do we do a Disney character version of this? You know, Disney everywhere. I mean, that's going to be, they're very, very quick to sort of jump on and try to replicate that. Is that what we're going to see?
I'm going to say yes. However, unfortunately, it'll be, I suspect that Pokemon Go is the World of Warcraft of this. I think that the World of Warcraft was maybe 5% better than every other MMO available at the time. But because it was 5% better, it's the one everybody collapsed around, and where their friends were and when all their relationships were part of, they wanted to do that because other people were doing that at this window of time when you could still charge $14.95 a month to be a member in a world. I can see, you know, Ingress did come before and it had limited, very popular success for at the time. But now this is going to be so crushingly good. I feel like this is the World of Warcraft of AR collecting geographically based games.
I mean, I think that it is its own genre though. And it will be flooded by a year from now. We're going to get a million different versions of it, and some will be good and most will be terrible. But I do think that it is a genre of game now, because what this game does is prove that people will get the hell out of their house. And that is a fundamentally different kind the fact that this is a success and not a niche success like Ingress was. Ingress, by and large, which to put in context for people, the difference between this Pokemon Go and Ingress is effectively competitive Foursquare check-ins. Right. You are taking one place for blue and one place for red by basically going there and being there. What I could see is A, evolution for Pokemon, and B, as a game, and B, man, I mean, if the WWE released their knockoff version, I'd get it. I'd play it tomorrow. I would love it. You could collect your different wrestlers and then, you know, pit them against each other. I think that'd be super fun. But this is a new genre.
That's an interesting idea, is the idea of, like you said, is that the what happens next is like, such and such, we got enough of these. There's going to be a fight, you know, at 7 p.m. between these wrestlers downtown in the park or whatever. We got to go watch that. I mean, that's I think my guess is, like, Brian, I hear your point absolutely about this thing, but I think that it is the beginning of augmented reality, really the big of augmented reality gameplay, that this introduces us to the idea of leave your house, go to these places, location-based and all that. And kind of the vision that we saw, we've talked about in books and stuff. I think that starts here, but I think that it doesn't end here.
Well, I'll tell you what it makes me think of is that scene in Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash, which so many people I talk to about how they should read Snow Crash, but they're like, oh, I'm just afraid it'll be dated. It's fun to see how much he gets right and how much is going to become right. I still highly recommend it. But one of the things they derisively call somebody is a gargoyle, because he's in a public place, but he's not disconnected. He's got goggles on, and it's just sort of rude and creepy. And, you know, he's aware of what's going on, but he's not engaging in that animalistic way that most of us do. I could totally see, let's say there's a big Lady Gaga concert coming, and everyone's going to attend the concert. But picture, I don't know, 5 more years from now, picture something the size and shape of the Vive, because you could wear the Vive and it's got a camera on it. Picture it being completely self-contained. If you could experience the entire concert not seeing everybody's dumb, stupid physical bodies around you, but instead seeing their super rad, you know, avatars that they built out before they even left for the concert, you know, the dress ups, you know, the awesome mashup, someone's in Iron Man armor, someone else is, you know, 20 feet tall or whatever. There's going to be a divide, and it'll be a fringe thing at first where everyone's like, that's really weird that these guys are going around with masks over their face, watching the whole concert that way. But then, you know, as people experience it, I think they're going to want to do more and more of it.
I think there might be part of that, but I think that eliminates a big reason for why people go to concerts.
Well, here's what I do think is, if we're to extrapolate what is novel and successful right now and gauge whether or not it continues or it tapers off, it's amazing to walk around the lake late at night and just meet people and see people and say hi and have something in common. There is this warm social element that, even though, you know, people, all they have to do is be within this geographical halo, right? And yet they stand next to each other and they talk to each other and they swap strategies and they ask about, you know, what they're doing and what level they're at. Like, this is unique. This is amazing, you know, and for it to happen spontaneously and almost on demand because it's so popular right now, I think that there is something to that experience. And as a game crafter, thinking about, well, how do you cater to that? How do you make a game that almost drives more into that? Like, maybe information sharing is part of the game, or trading, which is right now they say is coming to Pokemon Go, but is not there yet. Maybe trading becomes a whole other thing. I mean, that's why part of me thinks this Pokemon Go phase, I don't think that it's done growing, because it's a cool game, and I think the novelty of it will eventually slow down. But if they add in specifically trading and specifically you being able to battle your friends, which right now you're not able to do, that's a whole nother realm. Well, you know, that's a whole nother factor.
Think about what happens the first time. Let's say it's Pokemon Go. It doesn't have to be that, but it could be some success or whatever. But just as reCAPTCHA has transformed a chore into a universal benefit to help scan books, just as Duolingo is translating web pages and making them more available for everyone else, if you have a game that rewards going to geographic places all over, imagine the next time you don't have to get an Amber Alert that the whole world ignores on their phone. Instead, they work together, they contract with Pokemon Go, and they have a spread of an area, they make an alert, and they incentivize people to go to certain areas to accomplish important things. I mean, it could be one of the a tremendous boon for society.
I mean, I think just getting people out and having them interact at a bare minimum is something. I mean, interaction, we know as internet folk, you know, is kind of undersold as a benefit. But the fact that this has really just gotten people out of the house on such a regular level. John Teasdale, my co-creator on The Contender, you know, has a tendency to get a little. I mean, Andrews met him, you know, just recently. He has, you know, just gets very excited about things, and definitely spent 20 miles worth of walking within a day looking for Pokemon last week. You know, just being out there and seeing people, and it's just like, that's a game that's got its, you know, that's got grips into you, and I'm glad that it's that and not, you know, being inside. I mean, if you're really, here's the trend piece that I'm curious to see is like, what is the collective, you know, calories burned on Pokemon Go? And I'm sure they'd probably be able to give you some kind of number, even if it's just on the walking statistics.
I'm sure we'll find out. I think it's a fascinating story and it'd be an ongoing story. But I think it's time to wrap up this weird things with some picks.
Yep. Hey, I call first C's because I watched the first episode of Stranger Things on Netflix, and I am digging it. The whole world's talking about it. It dropped 2 days ago. It's got a 9.3, 9.4 rating on IMDb. It's set in 1983, starts with a missing kid. There's a supernatural. There's one kid goes missing, and another strange kid shows up. You got kids riding around on bicycles. Feels a little bit like Stand By Me or E.T. It's got that that Spielberg-type glow about it. It's nostalgic and well told. That's an important thing. Turns out just the setting and the plot are not the only things. You need to tell a story and get me engaged, and this one definitely is.
Cool. I'm looking forward to that. I have that on my watch list, so I'm looking forward to watching that. Justin?
Oh, man.
I'll jump right in. Give you some time. I just finished a really, really interesting book. And it originally came out like 1999. And then they did a new version of it like in 2006. And part of the conceit of the book when it came out was saying, hey, you think this is new, but we went through all of this before. And we're going to talk about why this is so similar. And the book is The Victorian Internet. And it's about the birth of the telegraph. And it's fascinating when you see the comparison between the telegraph and the spread of the internet, both the problems they faced, the solutions they came up with. It's by Tom Standage. So you have telegraphs. So you have one person on one end, a receiver on the other end, and they start building these nodes so you can transmit information. What did it mean to live in a world before when it took weeks to get news from even, you know, a week or so to hear from one part of the country to the other, and weeks to hear what was going on in Europe? That was the world pre-telegraph. Is that the world was a very, very far off, distant place. And then in the matter of a few years, all of a sudden we were connected by this magical device that was able to transatlantic cables, et cetera, which united the world, and people predicted, well, this is going to bring about world peace, finally. I don't know, that didn't quite work out, but it was this birth of communications, how much it was like the internet because of the way the nodes worked and transmitting information back and forth. People wanted to send encrypted information because if you were a business and you wanted to tell your supplier that you wanted to order X number of some product and you didn't want your competitors knowing, you needed to come up with a form of encrypting your messages. The problem was is the telegraph companies and the government didn't like encrypted messages. They wanted to know what people are saying. So they tried to limit the kind of encryption that they could use, and people found their ways around it because, well, that got broken and that doesn't make any sense now. People was very easy to decipher what was going on there. There were ways in which, how do you transfer money digitally? Because somebody said, you know, if I have a bank in Boston and I have a bank in New York and somebody wants to send money to somebody in Boston, used to be you'd send like a letter and go through all this, but we could do that on a telegraph. But we need to have a way for my bank manager in Boston to know that this is an authentic request to give this guy who shows up here money. And that's how Western Union was born, was Western Union figured out, like, we'll have two sets of books, we'll have our own encryption scheme, so we can send this information across an open network. And then on the other end, we'll know how to decipher, know if it's legitimate or not, because each time we use one code, we'll cross one off. You know, one-time pad, these hashes and things like this, this is where a lot of this originated from. Many of the solutions that came from the internet, you know, a lot of we talk about, oh, it came from the military, like some of the technological stuff. A lot of it came from actually the birth of the telegraph in the 19th century.
Well, and,
so
and not just
highly,
not-
highly recommend the book. It gets into just the, you get the early days of Thomas Edison. And I know that it's been in vogue to kind of like,
you know, Edison was a total jerk towards Tesla. We know this. We agree this. Edison was a guy with his moral scale swung back and forth. But Edison was a genius. Edison absolutely was a mechanical genius. You see the early stages of Edison and his involvement in there. And, you know, he was when he was like at the New York Stock Exchange. He's like a 20-year-old telegraph operator. And he was one of the fastest there was, partially because he was deaf. It made him easier just to focus on the dots and dashes. How, you know, he proposed to his wife through the telegraph, but he's at the stock exchange and the whole thing breaks and he figures out how to fix the problem. And the guy who engineered it's like, do you want a job? You know, I'll pay you, you know. And then Edison starts off building his own laboratories and stuff. And it's just amazing story. So I highly recommend it. It's called The Victorian Internet.
Yeah, and you of course the high-minded important stuff like encryption and all that stuff. By the way, I bought it while you're describing it. I put that on my Audible queue. But I was fascinated to find out that all of the translators had their own version of meme speak. You know, LOL.
Oh, yeah.
and all of that stuff. They were just in a chat room all day when they weren't.
So the telegraph operators would be sitting there. They're the ones communicating back and forth, and they got to know who was on the other end. They'd have like they like to sit like one line because it might be somebody they've never met, but they got along with, and it's like IRC or whatever. They said that they could tell who was on the line transmitting because of the way they dot and dash. They said that you could tell the difference between a man or a woman because of the way they did that.
Wow.
There was like one out of three telegraph operators was actually a woman. And so it was very much a precursor towards a lot of, you know, information network specialists today. But yeah, they had, you know, they would have meetings. The telegraph offices would have a meet, like a countrywide meeting where they would, you know, one person would be in there and send a signal out and go through all the other telegraph offices. And they felt as connected, you know, to each other that, you know, then as we do today. Now, again, this is where a small group of people had this technology. But yeah, they had jokes. They said that like most of the jokes being said back and forth were, you know, gross or anatomical in of nature or whatever. But it's just you see this and you go, man, like people will do what people will do, even if it was 150 years ago.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You got to pick Justin.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and pick the Scott Adams book, How to Fail at Everything and Still Win Big. It was recommended to me by Andrew, and I am very much enjoying it. Scott Adams, of course, the creator of Gilbert, walks you through his failures in life and specifically why he has decided that it is not goals that matter. It is systems and the building and adherence to those systems, you know, is very funny, and he is very, very open and honest, and I've enjoyed the book thoroughly so far.
How long ago did this come out?
I am not sure. Andrew, do you know?
I don't know. I'm sure if Bryce scrolls down on the Amazon page.
Oh, so yeah, 2013. Yeah.
2013.
Yeah, I think that like there's a big long jag into his dietary advice and stuff, which I just sort of droned on for me and I tuned out, but I thought I loved his talk about the goals, you know, the idea of why systems are better and what he means by that and understanding the difference between that. And then he gets into his whole idea of affirmations, which it's easy to misinterpret that as something else. But, you know, I know, Brian, you're a big believer in the idea of an affirmation. And I think a value of affirmations is that it reminds you what your focus is. It wires your brain towards what your opportunities are looking for. If you say, I'm going to do this, then everything you encounter, you're putting through that context.
Yeah, I think the biggest power of those things is, you know, we're story-driven people. That's why, you know, that's why we love moral lessons wrapped up in stories. That's why we, our one tribe will tell another tribe that this area is dangerous by telling stories and so on. And I think that we tell stories even to ourselves, and it matters what you decide in that regard. But I mean, I'm excited to hear his take on it.
Yeah, he's got a great – I think his blog is really interesting too, and that's worth checking out too. You know, he's not a person you have to agree with everything he says, but he's got a very interesting take on things, which is one of the hallmarks of people I find is interesting. You know, I love Christopher Hitchens because like he wasn't a person that I agreed with everything Hitchens said, but I always liked his take. I always said, okay, you know, I see what you're saying here, and this is a very interesting way to think about things. And I think in this environment we have this – Matt Ridley has an essay where he talks about how we live inside of our echo chambers and how the internet's made it even easier to do that and how people aren't – we're so unexposed to other ideas now that we just react to other ideas with outright hostility instead of, oh, that's interesting. You know, that's a thought. You know, like, I disagree with that, but I think it's a very interesting take. But we don't even want that now. We just don't want to hear. We don't want to know that other viewpoints even exist. And that's not a healthy mental attitude, I think. I think it's a sign of kind of a closed-mindedness when you're like, I don't even want to know that there's another point of view.
Right.
So, gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.